Okay. Maybe we could get going. David, not Sullivan. Father Kelleher is Sullivan, is a Irish name too. Let's see. Overview. Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, Science Museum. I thought Science Museum is first. Welcome and thank you for coming. Please identify yourself for the tape.
I'm Dr. Eric Jolly, the president of the Science Museum of Minnesota. With me is Kathy Wilson, our senior vice president for external relations. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I want to thank you for the time that you're giving us today. The Science Museum is in desperate need of your attention, and I want to thank you for that.
Just a pension, no money?
Well, we're hoping to get the first, Mr. Chair, and then we'll follow with the second. Most of your members are aware of the Science Museum as a great place to bring visitors and engage young people. You are aware that we're one of the most visited places for schools from across the state. And many of you also know that we're an essential part of the educational system in this state. In addition to supporting directly a number of the schools locally in their science education, we send our vans to virtually every county in the state each year doing in-school programming for all of our state students. We reach nearly one quarter of the students in their classroom every year. And we are among the largest providers of teacher professional development in math and science in the state. We believe our mission has never been more central to the needs of this state in supporting education and science literacy. We believe science is an essential literacy, essential for economic participation for our youth, essential for civic engagement of our citizens. As the state tackles weighty questions such as renewable energy sources, our water system and water quality, and other issues that are important to the quality of life of this state, the Science Museum is leading those discussions. Over the last 6 years, the Science Museum has pushed forward an aggressive agenda for education, outreach, citizen engagement, and we think we've been fairly successful, but it's been a very difficult 6 years. 6 years ago, the Science Museum enjoyed $1.3 million in state support and over $1 million in county support. But as this state faced its toughest challenges, the governor put forward a budget that zeroed out the Science Museum of Minnesota, and over time we've seen county support dwindle also to zero. Thankfully, through some of the members of this committee and the House and Senate working together, our budget was restored to $750,000 in that period 4 years ago, and that $750,000 was continued 2 years ago. Today we're asking to be restored to where we were 6 years ago. And I ask because it is so important to the value that we bring this state. During those last 4 years, the Science Museum has weathered on, but we are beginning to fray around the edges. Last year, I could come here and talk about our six vans that travel across the state bringing programming and resources to students, and our St. Croix Watershed Research Center and its centrality to setting water standards for this state. But today I only have five vans, and it will be a shame to come back 2 years from now and say, our service has been cut in half. We use those essential state dollars, such a small portion of our budget, but such a large portion of our general operating support. That $1.3 million would represent nearly one-third of the money that we use to clean the windows, vacuum the floor, and maintain a place that we can be proud of. We've worked very hard to try and retain our part of the responsibility for serving our citizens. With a $30 million budget, the $1 million that the governor has put forward warms us greatly. We're glad for that increase, but the $1.3 million will be essential for us to be able to continue to manage inflation and to stop the fraying at the edges. The Science Museum has more earned income than almost any other science museum of its type in the nation. We receive less community, municipal, state, city support than almost any other science museum of our sort in the nation. And we serve more people than many that are twice our size. I hope that this committee can help us as we try to meet the demands of the state for better education, closing the achievement gap, and providing stewardship not just for the life of our children, but stewardship for this state. The Science Museum houses 1.75 million artifacts that are a rich part of the heritage of this state. The Science Museum takes care of a 600-acre research facility that helps us offer stewardship for our water quality, natural resources, and environment. And the Science Museum manages a 500-acre nature center that keeps young people engaged with the real heritage of Minnesota. That is our wilderness, our lands. It's our hope for a future. And I do appreciate all of your considerations as we make our plea to please be restored for where we were 6 years ago. Our strategic plan has us advancing four goals, and I think it's more sharply focused than ever. The first one is reaching more broadly into a more diverse community. And we have done that with exhibits like Race and Body Worlds, seeing new members who have not related to us before, retaining our sense of relationship to students and schools, but reinvigorating our relationship to the adult audience. And we think that's important. Another part of our strategic plan is bringing our science to the public. Our researchers are on every continent for this year, helping us understand issues of global warming, of water quality, doing research in archaeology, ethnography, paleontology, bringing back 35 new specimens of dinosaurs, and invigorating the scientific community of this state. Our third strategic goal is to be at the forefront of education. So think about this. Today, a student spends in Minnesota about 174 days in school with an average of 15 days absenteeism. They spend 6 hours a day in school, only a quarter of a day. And so by the time a child goes from birth to high school graduation, they will have spent a total of 9% of their life in school. Schools do a pretty fine job with 9% of a child's life. They'll spend more than a third sleeping. They'll spend about 3% eating and occasionally bathing. And that leaves almost 42% of their time unprogrammed. Children don't have a button that stops and starts learning when they get on and off a school bus or walk into a museum or encounter a community education program. The Science Museum wants to be at the cutting edge of these programs, working with over 30 community-based science organizations from across the state to help them reach young people more effectively, taking advantage of that 42% of unprogrammed time. And that's an essential time in this state because Minnesota is ranked 46th in the availability of adult-supervised after-school and out-of-school programs, yet 42nd in the utilization of them, which means we're taking fullest advantage of the few resources we have. And the Science Museum is doing its very best to partner with others to extend our capacity in this state. Our work in education is nationally recognized. This month, the National Council of Teachers of Mathematics, with almost 40,000 members, circulated their member magazine, and on the cover is the Science Museum of Minnesota, leading the nation's mathematics education outside of the classroom and recognized by the National Council of Teachers of Mathematics inside the classroom. How powerful a message is that? I'm pleased to be the first person in the history of that organization to be asked to repeat keynote that organization, because what we're doing is so dynamic and changing. We're making Minnesota the center of attention in education. When the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration created a new technology for disseminating information from satellite data, they brought it to the Science Museum and said, help us learn how to teach others how to use this. And so we are at the center of being at the newest cutting edge of education. And our fourth strategic goal, financial responsibility. And we're doing that with four strong plans. Number one, increasing attendance. You can see how we're doing that with magnificent exhibits like Body Worlds and the upcoming Stunner, the last day of Pompeii, the largest exhibit of its kind to leave Italy with artifacts never before seen. It will only go to 8 cities in the United States, and the Science Museum is among the first of them. So we will increase our attendance to keep our part of the deal. We will increase our grant funding. We are now granted more from the National Science Foundation than any other science museum in the nation. We will do our best to renegotiate and manage our debt. We have a large debt, and it is something that we are attending to very strongly. We will launch an endowment campaign coincidental to our 100th anniversary. And our final hope for financial stability and creating the next 100 years is to plead with you to give us a chance to at least be back to where we were 6 years ago and help us keep the infrastructure in place so that those wonderful add-on programs can benefit the state. That would be my statement to the committee. I very much appreciate your time.
Thank you. Are you finished? Okay. Any questions? Well, it was all clear and no questions? Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony. And at first, I thought you weren't looking for money. I thought you were just looking for time.
We hope we've cleared that up.
Yes. Mr. Chair, we hope that we've made it clear that we're not looking for much.
Okay.
But thank you.
All right. Thank you. Yes, Nina? Okay, David and Nina. Welcome and identify yourself for the test tape, please. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Nina Archibald, and I'm director of the Minnesota Historical Society, and I would begin by thanking you for this opportunity, but also to thank you for taking the time to come to the History Center and to see firsthand, because I could sit up here for the next hour and a half, which you surely don't want me to do, and not paint anywhere near as graphic and wonderful a picture as the picture that you saw when you came to the History Center. You know that.
Popular trip this year.
Thank you. Glad to hear that. Minnesota Historical Society, just a word about who we are and where we came from. We have, since our beginning in 1849, been very close to the state of Minnesota. We were chartered by the first territorial legislature in 1849, the first organization created by that first territorial legislature, who had a real sense that they were doing something very special when they created Minnesota, and they were making an investment in this creation and wanted to see that it would be carried forward long into the future. They conceived it as an educational institution, one that would transmit the history and the heritage of the state in order to take care of what would come afterward. They set the organization up as one that would be close to government, but not of government. So we are guided actually by a governing board, limited by territorial charter to 30 members. The 6 constitutional officers also sit on that governing board, and I'm happy to say that at our governing board meeting last Wednesday, for the first time I think in our history, at least in my history, which is pretty long history with the institution, we had 2 members, constitutional officers, who were with us, and that was a really wonderful thing to have. We are governed also by the legislature through the statutory responsibilities that we undertake, which are outlined in Chapter 138, with which I'm sure most of you are familiar. The mission of the Society is to foster among the people of Minnesota an awareness of the state's history, to give them strength and perspective, but also to influence what happens in the future. I like to think of the Minnesota Historical Society as essential to the state's future. The values that have created this state and have sustained it are the values that are represented in its history. And in that sense, by preserving its history, we are trying to really influence the state's future. We carry out that mission by providing various and many, many kinds of different opportunities for people to learn, by collecting and by caring for materials that are the legacy, that are the evidence of the people of Minnesota's past, and by making that material accessible. 10 years ago, if I were to sit up here and tell you about how most people access us, we would be not making any sense to each other, because I'd be talking about something that we really didn't understand at all, and that is the power of the World Wide Web. And today we serve many, many more people, actually virtually, than we serve in person. Last part of our mission really has to do with we carry it out by encouraging the study of the state's history, both by our own people at the Society who work to prepare the exhibitions and the publications that you see, our products, but also by encouraging others to do research and to study Minnesota history as well. What we do every day matters a lot. Certainly our colleagues at the Science Museum are deeply invested in education, as we are. We're very much a part of the state's education system. We train teachers in how to teach history, as well as how to specifically teach Minnesota history. We also provide certain core government functions. I said that we were close to government, but not of government. We care for the state's people of Minnesota's public archives. The state archives are in our care. We also are involved in the mission of historic preservation around the state, taking care of the state's built environment, and certainly, as I said, we're part of the state's education system. We're part of the state's tourism economy. We run historic sites. I'll say a little bit more about them in a few minutes, but we run historic sites all over the state of Minnesota, and they are very much a part of the state's tourism economy. You only have to say for a moment that you plan to close one to find out just how important they are to the economy of a particular region. And we have a responsibility to the future, the kind of responsibility that I set forward just a few moments ago. Looking at the program itself, what does this all come out to mean? It means that we operate historic sites. It means that we operate museums, both at the History Center and at Mill City Museum, at the Mille Lacs Indian Museum. Those museums have wonderful exhibitions that serve the people of Minnesota, those who come both as families and casual visitors, as well as the many school children who come. We operate the state's historical library, and in that library we care for collections, including the state archives. We also manage those collections, because keeping track of the millions of items that we have is a part of our responsibility, and making them accessible through our reference system so that people can find the things that they want to find the information that they need when they come in. And we publish books. I just can't think of a time in my history with the Society, or as I look back over the past, when we have had a more vigorous publications program than we do today, both online, but particularly through our print publications, which we sell all over this country. We perform outreach. We don't only do this work where we actually have facilities wherever they are across the state, but we also do work with communities, assisting them with historic preservation problems they may have. We provide technical assistance to the county and local historical organizations. One of the great byproducts of having a strong state historical society is that we have many smaller historical organizations statewide whose work we support, and we support that in part by making grants to them as well as giving them technical assistance. And we have an archaeology program, both doing archaeology for our own historic sites, but also performing an archaeology service, particularly to the Department of Natural Resources. Looking specifically at our historic sites, it's a statewide network established by the Minnesota Legislature, defined in Minnesota Statutes 138. 23 of them at this point are developed and actually open to the public. I mentioned our tourism economy. These historic sites are really essential to the tourism economy, particularly in rural Minnesota. They are destinations for families, for tourists to the state, and for school groups as well. All this doesn't just happen. We need some sort of operations to make this thing go. So to make it go, we have a finance and administration operation. We take care of our personnel through our human resources and volunteer services. And I do want to say just a word about volunteers. We have some 1,700 individuals who spend time volunteering for the Minnesota Historical Society annually, which is a whole lot of people. That amounts to 24 FTE. Well, if you take an average salary and benefits and figure out what 24 FTE means to the state of Minnesota and means to the Minnesota Historical Society. It means a lot. They also bring wonderful attitude and a desire to give, which I find really quite remarkable. We, of course, have to communicate about our programs. We can't keep the light under the bushel. We try to market those as best we can. We raise private dollars as well through our development program, and we also try to keep our legislators and the governor's office aware of what it is we're doing, because you have a big stake in our operation. A word about the treasure that we hold in trust for the people of Minnesota. I think the thing that impresses me most about it is the incredible scope of the Society's collection and the depth of the Society's collections. When people ask me questions, when you ask me questions, very often I don't have the specific answers for you, but I can find the answers because the collections are there. You can see for yourselves in the materials that you have at hand the numbers of items, but the numbers of items don't say as much, I think, as some of the very special things that we have. I can't remember if when you were there we talked about the Huggins collection, which has just come to the Society. This is a collection of materials that surfaced in an estate sale in Palo Alto, California. And these are materials, they're a diary kept by one of the founders of the Lackey Pearl Mission, one of the missionary families, and he kept a daily diary for 30 years. That diary had been lost from view. His son also kept a diary. His son was killed in the U.S. Dakota War. Those diaries came to us along with tintypes, daguerreotypes, ambrotypes that give us a look at a whole period and place in Minnesota history that had really been lost to time. And so we're always looking and always collecting. A word just about those we serve. The numbers are large, a huge audience, certainly in person. Some 250,000 school children come to visit us at our historic sites. They come with their teachers. They come prepared to learn. They also come to the History Center in large numbers. In terms of total visitation, about 600,000 people come to our historic sites, about 225,000 to the History Center. We charge, of course, there's an admission fee, and that means we have very good numbers on who is actually coming through our door. I mentioned earlier that the web is the biggest audience that we have. We last year had some 6.5 million web sessions. If you haven't been onto the Society's website, I would encourage you to do so. It's an incredible place. You can lose whole days on that website. I mentioned education earlier. Some of you, as youngsters, may have done Westinghouse Science Fair projects. Those were very popular. They may still be, I don't know. But in this state, one of the great things that young people do is have History Day projects. They work with our collections. They work with the collections of the county and local historical societies. They collect materials in their own communities. And some 30,000 kids in Minnesota do History Day projects. They go off. They do very, very well. They compete with each other. 2 years ago, out of 14 first place prizes given in the nation, five of them were won by Minnesota youngsters. They did plays, they did little exhibitions, they wrote papers, they did one-person presentations. They just are as imaginative as can be. I think if you would come to the History Center about now on a Saturday, you would have trouble finding a seat because our place is full of kids doing research, preparing their History Day projects. One of the numbers that I don't think I mentioned when you were up is that as our membership, we have the largest membership of any historical society in the nation, and it has topped 19,000. Baseball is America gave us a real big boost. People came, they saw, they liked what they saw, and they wanted to become members so they could come back again. One of the things that we do that we'd like to do better is helping other organizations. What is that? It's a membership card. I like it. Good. We make grants because we want to help other organizations. We do operate grant programs for cities, for counties, and local historical organizations. We have a small grants and aid program, and over the years I've been at the Society, it's gotten smaller and smaller and smaller. Today, the grant and aid program, which uses general fund, makes a maximum grant of $7,500 to these county and local historical organizations. That's not much money. They have to match those dollars, and it really limits what they're able to do. A little bigger program we have is our bond-funded program, which allows us to make grants in larger amounts to take care of county, to some amount to county courthouses and other publicly owned buildings that would be eligible for state bond funds. The big gap, though, is the county and local historical organizations. The dollars we have in general fund dollars are simply too small. You think just of all 87 counties, and then you think about the total dollars, David, that we're able to grant in a year. is around $60,000. This is not very much money to take care of these needs. Also, for most of the county and local historical organizations, they do not have publicly owned buildings. They own their own buildings. And the result is that they are not eligible for the bond fund, so when their buildings fall to rack and ruin, there's no way that we can help them. So this leaves many, many good projects unfunded, and that's a real big concern of ours. The needs of others are a big concern of ours. In conclusion, I just like to say a little bit about values, which is sort of where I began, about why it matters that we do what we do. These are words that Elmer Anderson wrote and gave to us at about the time that the History Center was being prepared. He said, "There is no question that the values that built the past are essential to our future, but we cannot assume that they will be automatically adopted by future generations. The Minnesota Historical Society is a vital factor in preserving the best of the past and projecting it into the future. It's all about, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, about what happens in Minnesota tomorrow." I appreciate your attention. I'd like to turn it to David Kelleher to say a few words about the numbers. I don't know how much you want. Happy to answer any questions at this point that members may have.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, for the record, I'm David Kelleher from the Minnesota Historical Society. The next slide that you're looking at gives you a really quick snapshot of our state operating budget. The base budget amounts to just over $23 million for each fiscal year of the biennium. That is supplemented, as you can see on the pie chart, by other sources of funding, including revenue from things like admissions, store sales, and other auxiliaries, gifts from individuals and foundations and corporations, memberships, and grants. And that totals approximately $14 million each year. The cost to the state is just over $4.50 per Minnesotan to preserve our history, and we think that that's a bargain. The staff who do the work, approximately 180 full-time equivalent full-time employees and 191 full-time equivalent part-time employees. We have many seasonal and part-time employees working at historic sites and throughout the system. Just a quick word on some of the initiatives that are appearing in the budget, that are in the governor's budget, that are over and above the base amount. The compensation adjustment of 2% allows us to pay the costs of salaries, health care, and pensions that are the same with every agency and organization. Those costs are going up. The History Center building lease costs is a similar item. We have to pay the Department of Administration's Plant Management Division, who does a wonderful job keeping that building sparkling clean, and they take a lot of pride in the building. We have to pay fuel costs and the employee costs of the folks who take care of the building. Two of the next three initiatives were part of the governor's veteran support package, and there are a couple of individuals who want to quickly say a few words about that. I'll just quickly mention, in the Capitol Rotunda, there are a number of flags from the Civil War era, U.S. Dakota conflict, and Spanish American War era. Those flags desperately need conservation, and we hope to apply for some federal funding through the Save America's Treasures program that we would match with state dollars. That's a one-time appropriation, and that's part of the governor's budget in the veteran support package. Also in that veteran support package is an increase to one of our ongoing pass-through appropriations, the Minnesota Military Museum. And Mr. Jack Johnson, who's on the board of the Military Museum, will say a few words in a moment. Finally, the Sesquicentennial Commission, which the legislature created in 2005, is requesting an appropriation of $2 million. That's in the governor's budget at $2 million, and those funds would be used for grants and statewide celebrations to mark the state's 150th anniversary, which is coming up on May 11, 2008. So, Mr. Chairman, that's a quick view of the budget and the change items or governor's initiatives. We would be happy to go into whatever level of detail you'd like on the budget or answer questions that you have in general about our program.
Is it you, Jack Johnson, Mr. Johnson?
So this is Chuck Ergang, who's our Chief Financial Officer, and
he's here
to help with numbers if
you
have trouble.
Fine. Roseanne Kahn?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Kelleher, I have a couple of questions on how things are funded. I'm interested in the History Day occupation. Is that, what's the funding for that? Is that state general fund funding, or is it, how is that funded?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kahn, that program is a partnership between the Minnesota Historical Society and the University of Minnesota.
Uh-huh.
Its funding comes from a small amount of state funding, as well as some other non-state funding, some corporate donations, some individual donations, some foundation donations. For example, the Vadim Trust in Fergus Falls has funded school kids from that part of the state to have access to both the History Center, the university libraries, as well as regional libraries in their area. So it's a combination of state and non-state funding.
Mr. Chairman, is that program being held back by lack of funding at all? Are the people who don't, are there not, is there non-participation because there isn't enough funding available?
Yes, something about it. Mr. Chairman, Representative Kahn, I think what has happened is that there have been parts of the state that are basically not being served by the program. When the Vadim Trust got into it, we were able to go in. Partly, it's not only helping the children, it's helping the teachers, to train the teachers so that the teachers know how to help these kids through their programs. The Nielsen Foundation helped us up in Bemidji. We have some dollars that are helping us in southwestern Minnesota. I can't tell you offhand, but I'm sure that there are pockets of the state that we simply have been able to pick off where people have had a particular interest and helped us. Offhand, I'm not able to tell you where the blank spots on the map are, but I certainly could get that information for you.
I guess I would be interested in if you
we could certainly do that, Mr. Chairman.
Would there be an effect of some increase in state funding? You know, maybe a state funding that had to be matched by other fundings by local businesses or other groups or something for that. Then the other one is this issue of the county and local historical organization buildings not owned by public entities. Is there any chance of switching those into public ownership with private management of some sort? Is there some way of, I mean, a county, if it's owned by a county, it is public ownership.
That's
so that's
correct.
Good enough. And is there something that can be done? You know, is there some problem with I mean, is there some way where one could say to a historical society, you know, if you're willing to go into some, whatever agreement would be required with the county to own this building and you use it, and, you know, is there hesitation on the counties or what? Is that something that could be done so we could look at bonding facilities?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kahn, the ownership of historic buildings run by local historical organization is a patchwork of ownership. There are a number out there that are owned by either a city or a county or a township, and they are eligible to apply for bond funds. We have conversations on a regular basis with those organizations and kind of walk them through what's involved if they would like to try to access bond dollars. And in many cases, it's a group of volunteers that maybe doesn't want to relinquish ownership to their township or city, and they make that choice to not access the bond dollars. So we have those conversations on a regular basis with those organizations.
Well, I just wonder if maybe it might be useful to have a statewide conference on this and to have people, you know, to, instead of doing it on a one-by-one basis, to have a discussion about what could be done and how people could feel that they could, in a sense, retain the ownership even if the title was somewhere else. Some program that would make them feel comfortable about retaining the ownership with the actual ownership being elsewhere.
Right, Mr. Chairman, Representative Kahn, we do run preservation workshops and various workshops as part of the aid programs that the support programs, technical assistance programs. We also publish a newsletter where this kind of information could be disseminated, which is directed right at these organizations. Having been over this ground, I know for whatever reason there sometimes is resistance to relinquishing ownership, because sometimes there's literally money sitting there and they will say, no, we've got our blood in this and we don't really want to relinquish ownership. So I'm not sure. I think we can certainly try it and should and do. But and could do it in a more comprehensive way, because I think we tend to pick it off one by one.
But the question is also, Mr. Chairman,
question would also be having a facilitator who would kind of work with what their fears are and what, and are they realistic, are they not realistic, or
right.
something.
Right. Now, David is just reminding me that we have field services staff who travel all over the state all the time and certainly could do some of that work, and without talking with them, having them here, I can't speak for them, but I'm pretty sure that's a piece of it. It's hard to see things not happen when something could be improved by making a move, by transferring ownership.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Any other questions? Well, thank you very much. Thank you for your time. And
we appreciate your time, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Mr. Jack Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Jack Johnson. I'm from Stillwater, and I'm here to speak on behalf of the Minnesota Military Museum, which is located at Camp Ripley. I'm a member of the Board of Directors of the Military Historical Society of Minnesota, which operates the museum. I think you already have some basic information and numbers in front of you, but I'd like to add a little context. We operate on a very lean budget. We have no full-time staff. On the surface, the museum has done remarkably well, but there is a flip side to our success. With more requests for help, more artifacts, more books and archival materials, and ever higher public expectations. These growing expectations and an urgency born of accelerating change in the military presents us with a troubling dilemma. Pitting what we should do in light of our mission and recent historical developments against what we can do given existing resources. We believe strongly that these changes compel our museum to respond actively and quickly. The most profound change has been the steady expansion of American military assignments worldwide. You have heard about it. Peacekeeping missions, counterinsurgency operations, military occupation duty, humanitarian relief, homeland security, U.S. border security, disaster response, a steady procession of flare-ups elsewhere in the world, and ongoing wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. These things have stretched our military capabilities to the limit. For example, in the past 10 years, nearly 80% of Minnesota's National Guardsmen have been federally mobilized at least once. Since 9/11, most members of Minnesota-based Army, Air, Navy, and Marine Corps reserve units have been mobilized at least once for federal active duty. The history of these deployments and of Minnesotans serving in the active forces needs to be systematically documented. Exhibits that explain what is going on and that tell the stories of these Minnesotans need to be created. It falls to the Minnesota Military Museum to do this work. It is expected. We've done an excellent job with the resources we have, but we have only one half-time curator, not nearly enough to appropriately record, conserve, and care for 30,000 artifacts, document and record histories, and develop new exhibits while keeping ongoing exhibits fresh and up to date. The backlog of new artifacts that need processing keeps mounting. The museum lacks a computerized artifact database. There are many things we can and should do to improve programming and outreach, but it all requires staff time and specialized expertise. We've made heavy use of volunteers, but volunteers can only do so much. They require training, oversight, and direction from professional staff. We face a real dilemma. How can we reconcile our current capabilities with our certain conviction that we need to support our state-oriented mission and appropriately honor our current Minnesota service members and veterans by preserving the story of what they have experienced? We truly are at a critical turning point in our museum's own history, and that brings us to you. We request a major increase in funding in order to strengthen our collection and its management, to proactively document and educate the public about the recent military deployments and personal experiences of Minnesota's servicemen and women, to rework existing exhibits and create new ones, expand educational outreach, and increase administrative support. Our long-term vision is to have one of the finest state military museums in the nation, a dynamic institution that properly honors Minnesota veterans while providing genuine value to the citizens of our state. Governor Pawlenty recognized this by putting it into his budget. We seek to stay true to our mission and our vision, and with your support, we believe strongly that we can.
Okay, thank you, Mr.
Johnson. Thank you.
So you're satisfied with the governor's recommendation then?
Absolutely.
Okay, good.
Be happy to answer any questions anyone
okay,
might have.
Any questions? All right, well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
See, Kalen is here, Representative Kalen. And Representative Dunker, do you want to come down here and join us? Or, I mean, sit down with us, you don't have to. He's a longtime chairman of Economic Development, Finance, and so on. Not as old as I am. No, you're a year older, I think. Yeah. You corrected me. Yeah. Okay. Okay, Representative Kalen, you want to wipe out the fees. I guess there are no fees anymore, no admission fees to state capital tours. Is that right? But they still need money.
That's correct, Mr. Chair. A quick little bit of background information on House File 289, and then I'd like to ask David Kelleher to chime in a little bit from the Historical Society's perspective, and then actually have a suggestion. In Representative Porowski's committee, we always talk about making amendments rather than suggestions, but in this case, I have a suggestion to the committee about how we can proceed. As the committee probably knows, a few years ago, as part of the 2003 budget crisis, the $4.5 billion shortfall, when the Historical Society was asked to absorb pretty deep cuts to their budget, they did, I think one of the sort of most visible fees that came up was a $2 fee for charging school kids to visit the Capitol. And I think it's the goal here of House File 289 is to make a strong statement that our children, especially our school children, should never be charged a fee to come visit the halls of government. I think it's a really important lesson for an engaged citizenry, for our youth especially, to tell them that the halls of government are open and accessible to them, and that you need not put a couple dollars in the box to make it to the Capitol. I also heard from a few teachers and parents in my district and others where they were able to do it once, but if the fee continued, it actually would prevent some classes from coming to visit the Capitol. Mr. Kelleher and I have had many conversations over the course of the last couple months about the situation. Before I ask him to sort of talk a little bit about their plans to not charge a fee now and what they've done to look forward from the 2004 fee period, I'd also just like to say that one of the things that we did look at is what are all of the barriers that prevent school children from around the state from visiting not only the state capitol, but the Historical Society, the History Center, Fort Snelling, our wonderful other cultural and heritage resources that you all are on this committee charged with being stewards of, those teachers in the room just Mr. Bly, Representative Bly probably just shuddered with fright at my poor grammar there, but the essence of the bill remains, and I'd like to hand it over to Mr. Kelleher, and then I'll make my suggestion after he talks about a little bit of background.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, David Kelleher from the Minnesota Historical Society. I think Representative Kalen did a good job summarizing the situation. We did, in fact, have rather large budget cuts in 2003 that had an impact across our program in every area. We did have fee increases at our historic sites, and in fact have charged school children for visiting historic sites and the History Center for a number of years. We had not previously charged for a tour of the Capitol. Obviously, those tours take staff
admission fees are an important part of our funding stream. However, we got the message loud and clear from the legislature that you all did not want us to charge students coming to the Capitol for the general tour that fourth and fifth graders come. And what we did in conversations 2 years ago on budget setting time was agree that we would not charge fees. We will continue to do that in the foreseeable future. And you in the budget setting process provided some funding to offset the revenue loss that resulted from not charging fees at that particular historic site. Representative Kalin also referenced what the other barriers are to school groups visiting, and certainly transportation costs are one major factor. I personally have written a few checks for buses to come to the Capitol or the History Center or the Science Museum when teachers have run out of their allotment for field trips and they want to make one or two more trips. The buses are not cheap. So that's another barrier that ought to be looked at some point in the future for making sure that kids are able to take advantage of, as Representative Kalin said, the various cultural organizations that you fund through this committee.
And Mr. Chair, I think the appropriate way to proceed here for the committee, the suggestion that I might humbly make, is to look at the outcome of a similar bill that Representative Garofalo introduced a couple years ago. And rather than as Representative Garofalo's bill would do and as my would have done as my bill would do, rather than put the prohibition in statute to essentially allocate some of the money that will be appropriated to the Historical Society to offset the cost of providing the tours in exchange for putting essentially the sentence on line 1.10 and 1.11 in session law rather than in statute. So we'll retain the flexibility the Historical Society is asking for, but continue to make a strong statement that our children should not be charged a fee, no matter how small, to come visit the place where we work diligently and where their laws are made.
Okay. So that means that adults are still charged, but not the students, is that right?
Mr. Chair, adults are not charged either.
At the Capitol.
At the Capitol currently. We do, I should mention, some of the programs that we operate. There's a program for high school students that runs multiple days. And in the conversations that we had with the legislature last time, we were allowed to continue to charge for those because they are much more staff intensive. But the term general tours is commonly understood to mean the school groups that come in and have a 45-minute tour and then have a chance to meet with their legislator, and that's what we will not charge for.
Okay, thank you. Well, Representative Gardner moves that House File 289 be considered for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
So, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions? Comments? Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Okay. There he is. Okay. The people that are not on this committee have a priority, unfortunately. We are here all the time. We suffer here all the time. Okay. Representative Dabney, House File 1653. Who will move this one?
How about Mr. Chair? Can I suggest Representative Kahn?
Well, don't wait for it. No. Sorry, I was half asleep too. Okay.
Doesn't say much for Representative Kahn. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Representative Kahn moves that House File 1653 be considered for the inclusion of possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Good evening. The area surrounding St. Anthony Falls on the Mississippi River in downtown Minneapolis is perhaps the, arguably at least, one of the most significant historic sites in the state. The industry that developed there wove together Minnesota from border to border and wove together its early economy. Farming, milling, transportation, and grain trading, putting Minnesota into the global economy before the term global economy had ever been coined. The modern area, the modern history of the area, the last, say, 15 to 20 years, is one of a mix of public and private investments, spurring a great deal of activity and recreating a vibrant riverfront in downtown Minneapolis. The restoration of the Stone Arch Bridge, the creation of the Mill City Museum by the folks you just heard from, the Guthrie Theater, as well as the development of housing, retail, and office space in the area are a result of both those public and private investments. The challenge for both Minnesotans and out-of-state tourists is finding this gem that's hiding in plain sight in downtown Minneapolis. House File 1653, the bill before you tonight, provides funding for wayfinding and a signage system designed to help visitors find their way to the number of historic sites that are available in the St. Anthony Falls historic area. I have with me today Mr. Dave Kelleher from the Minnesota Historical Society to talk further about the plans for the area.
How many signs would this buy?
Mr. Chairman, also with us up at the table is John Crippen, who is the director of the Mill City Museum and also helps to staff the St. Anthony Falls Heritage Board.
Let's see if I can get an answer to that question.
Mr. Chairman, while he's looking for the answer to that specific question,
that's fine.
A couple of years ago, the St. Anthony Falls Heritage Board, which is made up of the Minnesota Historical Society, local government, city, county government, and other interested folks, put together a plan for wayfinding and signage for the St. Anthony Falls Heritage Zone. Mm-hmm. And this we can pass a couple of these around. This is a comprehensive plan that looked at how people travel, came up with preliminary designs for signage to help people get to those places where the state has made a huge investment, both in Mill City Museum, the trails, the bridge, the Guthrie Theater, and other major features on the riverfront. Do you want to add anything?
Yes. I'm John Crippen, as David mentioned, with Minnesota Historical Society. To answer your question, Mr. Chair, it's approximately 200 signs that we're looking at throughout the riverfront district. And we do have a couple of visuals if you want to use those to show what area we're talking about.
Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
Well, they're preparing that, and maybe it's all ready to go. I just had a question.
Okay.
Does your project need to go through MnDOT? They've got a variance board, and I've fought with them for about 10 years. I'm just wondering if that's part of the process that you need to deal with to get permission. I assume these will be on state, like on the interstate and so forth.
It would be both, Mr. Chair, Representative. There are six different sign types, and one of the sign types is for the Interstate System 35W nearby the Riverfront District, and the plan calls for signs that would have to be approved by MnDOT, and that's included in the bill before you. However, if we can't get those variances or we can't get that negotiation completed, we can begin on the other parts and implement the majority of the plan.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nornes, if you look on line 11, it directs the Department of Transportation to cooperate with the Historical Society, the Heritage Board, and the City of Minneapolis to install the signage to the Central Riverfront for major trunk and interstate highways.
Mr. Chair, I brought it up only because I know that the problem we ran into was they have some rules and regulations as far as how far from the destination they'll put signs and that kind of thing. So just you're aware of that probably, but we finally resolved it. I just was hoping to warn you if you hadn't, so.
Yes.
Okay. Were you going to...
Sure, just a couple other things, Mr. Chair, Representative. The plan, part of the process of the plan was going through systematically figuring out all of those review processes, so we do have that documented in the plan, and we can go forward. The visual that's in front of you further explains a little bit where these roughly 200 signs would go. The Riverfront District is roughly defined by 35W on the right hand of the screen, Plymouth Avenue up at the top of the screen, 4th Street southeast on the west bank, or the east bank of the river, sorry, and then Washington Avenue at the bottom of the screen. So it's roughly contiguous with the San Anthony Falls Historic District, but we expanded the boundaries a bit to take into account major thoroughfares, drive-throughs, where people are actually coming into the area, and to highlight, as Representative Dabney said, historic properties, but also other amenities in the area. One of the strengths of this area is it's a great partnership of private, public, cultural organizations beyond just historic, obviously.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you. Anybody? Representative Erdahl?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Of the 636,000, approximately how much of that is signs?
Mr. Chair, Representative, if I understand this question correctly, it is all signs.
Oh, it's all signs?
Right.
Okay. Representative Bean and I would do it for $500,000.
Okay. Is there a chance for, it's local money, private foundations, or even federal, you know? I mean...
Mr. Chair, we haven't done active fundraising for this project to date. We've been keeping our ears open and looking for opportunities. So far, those opportunities have not come forward. However, go ahead.
Go ahead, yeah. Okay, St. Anthony's Falls doesn't have any staff. They don't, do they? I mean...
That is correct.
Oh, okay. All right.
The Heritage Board proper does not have staff. That is paid staff. It's donated by each of the member organizations.
Oh, okay. Okay. Representative Madori?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have to tell you, Representative Dabney, I've had this experience. I wanted to take my Boy Scouts down to visit the falls, and not knowing what it was supposed to look like when I got there, I was walking around and around and around, and I finally asked a gentleman that was nearby, and he says, well, it's right there. So I think this is a very good project. I just want to let you know.
A gem hiding out in plain view.
It really is. Thank you.
It's hard to find places. I drove Yellow Cab in Minneapolis a long time, about close to 50 years ago, and I got fired. Couldn't find any place. Because how come you put on so many miles and no money? I said, well, because I can't understand what they're telling me over the radio, and I can't find places. They were desperate to hire me because of the strike long back in the late 60s or early 70s.
Mr. Chairman, I think if we had the signage program, you might
I was
not be
a
here.
Republican. Rosette Kahn?
Yes. Mr. Chairman, first of all, what's the, what was, for the Mill City Museum, what was the cost sharing in terms of state, federal, and private funding on that?
For the building of it?
The Mill City Museum, yeah.
The funding structure for the Mill City Museum, the original capital. You know, up your head.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kahn, state dollars, there were $7 million worth of state dollars into that project, and the balance was a combination of other public dollars and privately raised dollars.
And the total amount was?
Approximately $30
million. I mean, seems to me, Mr. Chairman, that there should be some appropriation for this, but I don't understand why there aren't some matching funds available from somewhere to help do this. This per sign, that just seems like a very big number somehow.
DOT will have a lot of money after we raise the gas tax and pass the bonding bill, hell, they should be able to pay. Okay. Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Kelleher, are they generating power at St. Anthony Falls yet?
Mr. Chairman, I believe XL Energy is generating power as they have been for many years. If you're talking about the Crown Hydro project on the other side of the river, I don't believe they are yet, but on the east bank of the river, XL Energy continues to generate power.
How far along are they in the Crown project?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gunther, as I understand it, the Crown Hydro representatives are negotiating with the Minneapolis Park and Recreation Board at the moment. The land under consideration is owned by the Park Board, and so the recent action that I'm aware of, the Park Board authorized up to $20,000 to have a consultant to study the issue a little bit further. It was about 2 years ago that the Park Board denied the request for selling or leasing the land, and so then the project has remained quiet for a couple of years, and it just came up again about 2 months ago with the Crown Hydro folks renewing their effort. Yes, thank you. It is a different plan. They've altered the location of the plant, put it a little further upriver, and attempted to make it less visible from the general area.
Okay. Representative Gardner?
But Representative Erdahl was ahead of me.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't have you on.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I'll let you get heavy here.
Who makes the signs? Who does make
them? Blacksmith.
Mr. Chair, Representative Erdahl, we haven't gotten that far along in the planning. This is a general master plan for the signs, and were we to get funding and move forward, we would have to go into a little bit more specific design development to have the final specifics made, and then we would go out on the open market looking for a vendor to make the signs.
Mr. Chair,
we haven't identified that yet.
Mr. Chair, if I can help answer that question. Okay. Yeah, M&R Sign Company in my district makes a lot of those signs. I'm not sure I'm for this, but at least they would be in the bidding process.
Do you have any stock in the company?
No, he's a friend of mine, though. And you on this, too?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, first of all, I've had a lot of complaints from people about the signage, not specifically in this area, and there are signs. There are big signs up there that you... And in fact, when the signs were first put up, there was a lot of discussion about whether when, you know, you're looking at a sign and you can't tell which way west and east is, you don't have examples of the signs that you have up showing the historic route around that. But there have been I've had lots of complaints from some of my running companions who seem to think that they can blame me for anything that goes wrong on a public street that we're on, of the signs, the Park Board signs on the Grand Round and so forth. And I don't know those. There are lots of ground signs with lots of information on it, which is totally unreadable from a car, not very, and very hard to figure out even when you're standing in front of it and doing it. So, you know, I'm kind of unhappy. You know, I know you're not the Park Board, and I guess, and the Park Board consistently said that they didn't pay for those kiosks, and there are lots of kiosks with nothing on them, and you know, so how, what is going to assure us that this money is going to be well spent?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kahn, up on the screen now is just a smattering of what the study went through as we came up with this plan, and they did an extensive graphic standards review trying to make sure that what they created unified the district as opposed to further created chaos amidst a really dense urban environment. If you can move forward a couple of slides. This is an answer to a previous question as well. Some of the signs in terms of manufacture would be the simple highway signs, brown highway signs that we all are familiar with. Others would be manufactured or created specifically for this with this design. And then this slide shows incorporating this signage plan into the existing. And so what you see there in the kiosk is one of the Heritage Trail kiosks. And a key portion of the design for this sign plan is an arch motif that goes on the top of the wayfinding sign. And we would carry that through to other existing signs, including the Heritage Trail kiosks and including the Park Board Grand Round signs, so that when you get into the Minneapolis Riverfront District, you've got that. We've got a unifying presence between the existing signs and the new ones that we're proposing. Right.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Gardner.
What?
Hold on.
Yeah,
okay. And Dean, Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had the job of trying to make signs for a college campus to help kids find their way from one building to another building. And they actually did a study of the ability of the students to read the plans that we were doing with, you know, north, south, east, west. And almost none of the students, and this is my former college, so I'm not going to say which one it is, could tell where they were on the map or find where they were going. And we had developed standards, the three-dimensional standards of wayfinding that were pictorial and not graphic-based. Do we have any kind of standards like that? Out of, you know, and then you kind of get into the language barriers, too. Is there any standards outside of ADA, or do you guys have standards that help people find their way around that aren't a waste of money?
Mr. Kelleher, or is it not that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dean, I'm not aware of any standards that we have and subscribe to. I guess I would say, in response to one of the previous questions, the report that's going around that thick, we had a consultant who does this kind of work on a regular basis do it, or the Heritage Board, I should say, did that. And they know better than we do, and hopefully they know, you know, better than the college students that you have to deal with, and they know what works and what doesn't work. But to answer your question, we don't have a, you know, graphic standard for museums, or we just try to, on a case-by-case basis, figure out the wayfinding for that particular place and what works. But I think your idea of graphics rather than words is a good one to help people overcome language barriers.
What I ended up doing was I went to the Nicollet Mall because I thought theirs looked really cool, and they had a 3D modeling program. We just copied what they did. So whoever, I'm sure we paid for that study, so at least we got double duty out of it. But it is kind of interesting when you're trying to get people from one place to another. You can't just tell them where to go.
Any other questions? I know in our any college campus, having the signs glow in the dark actually can help keep people whacking their head. Let's see. Representative Conn, would you like to renew your motion to lay this over for inclusion in the omnibus?
Yes, bill? But I'm really looking at a little bit more specificity in the appropriation and maybe some phase one and phase two in doing this. It just seems I still haven't gotten to see any of the existing signs that they have.
Mr. Chair, Representative Conn, the budget detail sheet in the plan, two things about it. One is that the budget detail has been updated since that plan was published almost 3 years ago, and so we can get you those numbers if you'd like that detail. Second important point on that is that this is an eminently feasible project. We've broken out the different sign types so that we can, in a very planful way, say, let's bite off three phases right now instead of trying to do it all at once. So that would work. Page 65 is the budget from 3 years ago, and that shows the phasing that I was mentioning, group 1A and 1B, and then 2 through 8 as well. And so if you're interested, we can work with you on what would be the appropriate phasing and how you might want to modify that.
Okay.
present the content review for motion.
So the bill will be considered a possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I appreciate the time.
Thank you. Did you say that, was it Hamilton is here?
Okay.
Since he's not part of the committee, we'll give him a chance. Thank you. Welcome, Representative Helen.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. So I see a lot of friendly faces, so that's a good thing. Today, Mr. Chair, do I need to have somebody move my bill?
Well, just go ahead and explain it, and
what was that comment? I missed that.
I'll move that it be passed and referred to Finance Committee to be sent to Representative Hans' committee where my bill is, and perhaps they can have a, I don't know what's, if they're the same gender, if they have, do they get married?
I'm going to avoid the gender comment. However, I think that the two should be married, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Yeah, I guess they don't have, they're inanimate. Okay.
All right. Well, I guess just to explain the bill here a little bit, Mr. Chair and committee members, I do have a couple of people here to testify on behalf of this bill also. I mean, the technical side of it, basically what we're doing here is establishing committee, if you will, a commission, the Minnesota Commission on New Americans, to develop and capitalize on the strengths of the immigrant communities, facilitate the full participation of the immigrants in social, cultural, and political life. And you can take a look as far as the makeup of the group and the qualifications of the group. I mean, on a personal note, when I was seeking additional input on this, I did what any grown man would do. I called my mother and get some feedback from her. And like she said, when my great-grandfather came into the United States here, all he spoke was German. And he had a difficult time. You take a look at when my grandfather was born, that was right around World War I. He, too, spoke German. When my mother was born, it was right before World War II, and she was still speaking a little bit of German growing up. They had a difficult time. You take a look at the small community in which I do live in, small town of Mountain Lake, less than 2,200 people. Back in the early 70s, it's a Russian Mennonite community. Back in the early 70s, the churches were actually going overseas and bringing families back over to Mountain Lake in Minnesota from Laos. And the first generation had a very difficult time basically understanding the cultures and the language, et cetera, et cetera. The second generation in Mountain Lake are now business owners, opening up businesses. The third generation, which actually goes to school with my children now, they're scholars. They are stars on the basketball team. They are up for homecoming king and queen. I mean, they're very much a part of the community. However, again, it's taken about three generations. And, you know, you can argue that, whether it's right, wrong, or otherwise. However, it doesn't need to be that difficult in my mind. And I think this is one step what the Minnesota Commission on New Americans does, once again, is to reach out to new Americans and help to bring them into the community and basically build off of their strengths also. So, Mr. Chair, with that, I do have a couple individuals to testify, I believe, or one.
Welcome. Identify yourself for the record.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is John Keller. I'm the Executive Director of the Immigrant Law Center of Minnesota. We're a nonprofit legal office. We represent immigrants from all over the state and from all over the world. Last year, we represented around 1,400 folks and provided educational presentations to over 4,500 members of Minnesota. It's my great pleasure to testify in favor and accept the invitation of Representative Hamilton to be here as a member of my office, also as a member of a firm, a coalition of organizations that include labor, faith, and nonprofits working for immigrants. The Minnesota Commission on New Americans, House File 1315, here in Minnesota we have one of the most diverse populations of immigrants and refugees in the nation, with the largest or nearly the largest U.S. populations of Somali, Hmong, Liberian, Ethiopian, and a substantial Spanish-speaking population. This commission would provide an opportunity for those who come here, who persevere, who work very, very hard, just like those who came in generations past and outlined in the recent film here from Minnesota, Sweetland, to have a way to be supported not only by the local communities where they're at, but also by this commission and by the state of Minnesota. It's a vital way in many ways to build on that strong tradition of immigration here in Minnesota. We have led for years in the resettlement of refugees and have accepted a greater proportion of the U.S.'s refugees from all over the world, as I mentioned. The creation of this commission demonstrates that Minnesota is serious about understanding and promoting positive immigration policies for the state, while the parameters of what the commission will study are outlined. They are still open, and of course those who are elected or nominated to be on the committee will help define what they are, but some of the areas that they certainly could work on include the importance of welcoming new Minnesotans into Minnesota's workforce, especially as more and more native Minnesotans begin to retire. Whether or not to support comprehensive federal immigration reform, as immigration laws are in fact federal in nature and preserved there by the Constitution. The important role immigrants play in keeping rural schools functioning and communities thriving. Strengthening Minnesota's educational opportunities for immigrants at all levels. Strengthening and promoting immigrant and refugee entrepreneurship, access to lending, smart home ownership programs, and building trust and understanding between the immigrant communities, law enforcement, healthcare, and helping dispel myths about immigrants and refugees. In finishing, I point out that Minnesota is taking a lead in doing this. There is one other state that I'm aware of that's done this, and it's Iowa. There was a commission on new Iowans, I do have some of the findings and work that they've done. Similarly, here in the state of Minnesota, the League of Minnesota Cities, under the direction of Mayor Les Heitke from Willmar, has also engaged in a serious and ongoing set of recommendations for municipalities. It's my hope that you'll take House File 1515 up to date and pass it, and I know that by doing so you'll lend strength and credibility to the entire state, in creating positive policies for all of Minnesotans. Thank you.
Okay. Well, thank you. Anybody else? Do you have anybody else? Okay. Well, thank you. Representative Kahn just mentioned, and I think it's probably a good idea that we just transfer the bill by a memo. As I said, that's the way my bill, went to governmental operations finance, so that it doesn't get stuck in the governmental operations policy committee, you know.
Okay.
And then it would be difficult to get it off. But we won't have a commission, a big commission. We'll try to accomplish it without too much bureaucracy, you know. So we'll put it in LCC, where we created an international visitors program there to have a part-time staff person, and then the ethnic heritage and new immigrants could be housed in the same place, right in this building. And without, you know, too much overhead.
Very good, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
I assume Representative Hamilton hasn't had any, and even though they mentioned that the Legislative Coordinating Commission shall provide the administrative and clerical support services, have you talked with them or talked with the staff of the LCC?
Myself, personally, no, I have not, Representative Hamilton, Mr. Chairman.
Probably not a bad idea. To try and get some idea as to what kind of an appropriation is going to be needed for, even with this Chair Yaris's idea of blending these together in a more efficient and better working form, I think we need to have some conversations as to what we're going to need in terms of staff and arrangements and so forth.
Mr. Chair. And Representative Kahn, myself and Chair Yaros, we've had these conversations, a number of these conversations, so we're working together, but your point is very well taken, and we'll be sure to follow up on that.
Greg is downstairs in the ground floor.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, well, thank you. And any other questions, comments? Well, thank you very much. Thank you. And then now we have Erdahl. But how many bills do you have? 30? No, three. Three.
But we can do them quick. Don't go away.
And then maybe Resident Gunter, I thought we were going to have one bill, but we have three of them. That's fine.
Well, actually, good. Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
It's a third, but I'm going to be quick.
I
think we can do the the first two bills. We could do 18, 60, and 61. I think we could do at the same time, and then 62, separately. Is that all right?
Okay. Go ahead, Resident Erdahl and Gunther.
Do you want me to move 1860 and 1861 for possible inclusion? Actually, I'll say probable, but I'll say possible inclusion.
Oh, okay.
1860 and 1861 are both appropriations for historic building, historic buildings and site preservation. One deals with a revolving loan fund, and the other is just a direct appropriation. Minnesota has many buildings of historic significance that are in danger of destruction and are in need of repair. Historic sites are sometimes ignored, become forgotten, and in disrepair. I urge the committee to keep our heritage alive by considering doing one or both of these bills in some fashion. I have talked to the Historical Society about this. I think that their preference would be a direct appropriation if they could get that, but they also could work with a revolving loan if that's, I think, how it came out. But I urge us to look at doing something in that regard for the preservation of our historic buildings.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Dean?
Mr. Chair, I see Mr. Kelleher here. Does he have a position or want to speak to that from the Historical Society standpoint?
Okay.
This say sounds good to me.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dean, you heard our Director Nina Archibald testify earlier about the need for grant programs and how those dollars are really small. And whether it's historic buildings or historic programs that county and local historical societies are operating, we really feel that there need to be more dollars going out to those programs. We appreciate the effort on the part of these two legislators to bring this forward. That's an area that was reduced in our budget reductions a few years ago, and it should be higher. The amount of dollars going into that should be higher, and we'd be supportive of whatever funding you guys can put into grant programs. As to the specific approach, whether it's a grant program or a revolving loan program, I would say that we've never operated a revolving loan program. So we don't have a lot of expertise in how to do that. I know there are other organizations in state government, like the Housing Finance Agency, that we could look to them for advice on how to do that, but we don't have a lot of expertise in operating such a program.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Kelleher, could you just talk a little bit about how you see this would be a small construction project, perhaps seen more as regional rather than statewide for historical significance, for example, for bonding. Could you talk a little bit about how you see projects like this for this committee or the bonding committee, ways to accomplish more of these projects from your perspective? I mean, I sitting on the bonding committee, I would like to do projects like this. I think we bond a lot of dollars for great big buildings, and it would be nice to be able to have some mechanism for significant local regional historic projects like this.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dean, if I understand your question correctly, a way to do that is to keep some dollars in the pipeline. From time to time, this committee and the bonding committee receive bills for specific projects that are small dollar amounts for the bonding committee, on the order of $50,000 to $200,000. That's small for that context. Keeping dollars in the pipeline for a grant program. We've operated grants programs since 1969. We have staff who do that. We have staff who are out in the field who know these buildings and what makes a good project. It's a competitive grant process with a review, rigorous review and feedback on how a project should be done properly. So if that gets to your question, what's a way to accomplish that? You know, keeping a good amount of money there so that organizations know that when they have a project coming up, they can rely on it. Otherwise, the alternative is to talk to their legislator and put a bill in for an individual project. You know, you guys may or may not know whether it would be a successful project, whether it would be meeting criteria that we would set out for a grants program. Does that kind of get at your question?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Keller, yeah, I think it does in some way, but we the last time on the bonding tour, we saw lots of small towns with really great projects that would be nice to be able to address on a statewide basis with criteria that's measurable that they could compete against each other, whereas it's really more who's representing where or who's invested in what area, not necessarily what the historical significance of the properties are.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dean, we talked a little bit earlier about when we have two types of grants that we put out there, and we have for about 10 years had a pool of grant money from the bonding bill that has gone out to anywhere from 8 to 10 and more projects, and you know, we can provide you with a list of those projects. Those have been very successful. They're small in amount. They're on the order of, you know, $75,000, which for a courthouse or a city hall will redo the roof or put in new windows but not do major work. But it gets some dollars out there and gets some projects done.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, I will renew my motion then for 1860 and 1861.
Okay, Mr. Erdahl moves that the bills 1860 and 61 be considered for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Then moving to 1862, Mr. Chairman, I will move that for a possible inclusion in the omnibus bill as well.
Okay.
This one, I should see Representative Morrow here, but he has a very similar bill to this one. Representative Gunther has been working on this bill as well. And
right. I was just asking him. I've seen the bill, but I don't think it has come to our committee yet.
Is that right?
I've seen it.
Anyway, it's very similar to this.
Right.
As a former Meeker County Historical Society president, I urge your consideration and support of an appropriation for county historical societies on a one-to-one match. The appropriation here is left blank. The judgment of the committee certainly is hoped for in a favorable way. The county historical societies are often strapped for funding. This appropriation could go a long way to helping them to interpret Minnesota history.
Mm-hmm. President Gunther?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The times that you're in are very, very good compared to the times that I was the chairman. I remember Nina Archibald coming to my office with a very distressed look on her face, and the results were that they started charging $2 to have sixth graders come tour the Capitol. Always bugged me that Carl Pollad could have gone there for nothing, but we won't get into that.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I had Representative Solberg bother me. Gunther, how can we get these volunteers who Ms. Archibald mentioned with great reverence to keep on working and keeping these outstate historic sites open. I think of Forestville. I think of the Forest History Center. And it kind of grates on you, so I come here today to kind of make up for one part that wasn't touched, because we opened the outstate historic sites. We got rid of the $2 fee. And what I'm trying to do now is trying to come up with a viable solution for the county historic sites and other areas that need to be looked at. And certainly the appropriation that I would put in there would be $1 million. I think $1 million is very appropriate. I think they have been having a long drought, and it's time that you get to...
Is that enough?
Well, that's a good start.
Okay.
It's probably not enough, no. Mm-hmm. But it's time that you get to take care of some of the things that I had to swallow, and it was not a fun time for any of us. Year after year, I think my committee was hit percentage-wise the hardest of any committee in the legislature. And there were many nights that I didn't like the results of what we were doing. And this is one way that hopefully the committee can look at correcting that error and coming up with that money, because it's certainly something that I think is long overdue and wasn't funded enough to begin with before we ran into hard times. And Mr. Chairman, you were there when times were good, and I was there when times were bad. Now hopefully you can correct these bad times that I had.
Well, thanks for your help. And President Gunther, do you think that this bill, you know, limits projects to those that can't be bonded for? Is that right?
I think it does, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
I think it does.
And then next year, hopefully, we can do more on the bonding.
We'll look forward to that.
Okay. Any questions, comments? Okay, Representative Erdahl has moved that House File 1862 be considered for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Okay, thank you.
Renew my motion. Thank you. Is it good time, Mike, or Mr. Chairman?
I don't care. In Bosnia, you said that there's a saying, you can even call me a pot, just don't break me.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman of the committee.
Okay, thank you. Minutes of the last meeting, the 12th, March 12th.
I would move approval of the minutes.
Any discussions? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Thank you. Thank you very much for your participation and attendance.